So today I'm going to read out some stuff by Thanachan Dun that's been translated and transcribed by Ajahn Chandoko some years ago. It's part of a collection put together called Kruba Ajahn. It's not publicly available unless you know someone. So here's Thanachan Dun. This talk is titled The Spirit of a Warrior. Ajahn Chandoko asks, Venerable Ajahn, how does one arouse the spirit of a Dhamma warrior? Thanachan Dun, a warrior? A warrior is one who battles to overcome his enemies. As monks, your enemy is kilesa. The kilesa is in your own heart. To generate the resolute faith that it takes to battle with kilesa, you have to regularly contemplate death, marnusati. When contemplating death, your heart awakens to the fact that this life of yours is not a sure thing. Regularly reflecting that your life is but a day and a night will arouse the warrior spirit. In the depth of your heart, imagine your death. Tonight is Wanpa, and at midnight you have to die. Convince yourself with mindfulness and wisdom until there's acceptance. When you lie down to rest at midnight, you will die. There's no tomorrow. You expire at midnight. What are you going to do? The spirit of a warrior is born. Once we're finished with this meeting, you definitely get out there on your jhangram path. For sure you wouldn't go read a book or listen to a tape. You definitely wouldn't do anything else but alternate sitting and walking meditation, because you're convinced you will die at the stroke of midnight. The warrior spirit is born. The past is gone, so there's nothing to worry about. Establish your mindfulness in the present. The future? Tomorrow doesn't exist, because we die tonight. Thoughts about tomorrow's meal and alms rounds and where we're going to go the day after next all vanish. Everything ends tonight. The mind won't be able to dwell on tomorrow. It's like throwing a tennis ball against a wall. When it hits the wall of midnight, it bounces back. Throwing the ball stands for your distracted thoughts concerned with the future. They just bounce back after hitting the wall of midnight. When attempts to think of the future are foiled, thoughts come to a halt. You can't dwell on anything that would happen after midnight. You can't think of tomorrow's alms round and an upcoming house invitation or the work projects that you were going to do. It all ends at midnight. The mind will stop in the present moment with sustained awareness. You sit and walk meditation without forgetting that you will die tonight. This is how you generate the spirit of a Dhamma warrior, the warrior that engages combat with the kilesas in his heart. Contemplating death is very helpful. It cuts off infatuation and delusion. It calms anger and sensual desire. What's the point in being greedy for sensual desire? What's the use of being angry when you know that you bite the dust tonight? You've got to purify your heart in time. If you contemplate death often, you won't become overly concerned with the future. Even if your thoughts proliferate a bit, you'll have the means to bring it back to the present. Everything that you've experienced in the past has vanished. Assess your heart. Since you're ordained, have the kilesas diminished or not? If the kilesas aren't diminishing in strength, aren't being abandoned, then this is just a waste of time. Sustaining awareness in your meditation brings up the faith to apply effort intensively. From now until midnight, you'll definitely go do sitting and walking meditation if you truly believe you'll die tonight. Do this every night. If it does happen that this night passes and tomorrow at 3 or 4 in the morning you open your eyes to discover that you're still alive, then again create the perception that you have merely one more day to live. Tonight at 10 or 11 o'clock, my life will cease. Today, I've got a day of life. If that's the reality, how are you going to spend your time? Hurry. From morning till 10 or 11 at night, just put effort into your meditation. Continuous effort. But you have to imagine death in a way that your heart sincerely believes. Even though it may not actually be true that you'll die tonight, this is a skillful means that we employ to startle the heart. It awakens the fear of imminent death. If you reach your hour of death unprepared because your meditation hasn't been sufficiently developed, you'll have no refuge to take shelter in. If mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom have not yet been established in your heart, you'll have no refuge. So for the time remaining, it's imperative to practice intensively. The skillful means of contemplating death is key. It can uproot your attachment to your body. You have to find ways to achieve victory over the kilesas in your heart and mind. Don't allow them to persist in your consciousness. Don't hold on to and imprison them. Find ways to let them go and cleanse the heart. It's necessary to let go of those attachments. When kilesas do appear, clean them out. Wherever you go, you're shadowed by your kilesas. Wherever you are, the kilesas are there in your heart. Once this is understood, you incessantly generate mindfulness to care for and consistently look after your own heart. This is to put forth great effort. The more you do, the more you benefit. The sages of old lived simply, content with whatever they had. They'd go off to live in peaceful and secluded places to develop meditation. Slipping away into solitude, they were free from the disturbances of community life. They didn't socialize too much with the community. That's the way it was in the old days. That led to knowing and seeing Dhamma. These days, there are just a lot of issues, issues that aren't concerned with the Dhamma. So there's a lot of mental turmoil, and the results of Dhamma practice rarely arise. The results come too slowly because people prefer these worldly issues to the issues of Dhamma. As monks, we should practice in solitude, developing bhavana a great deal. Results will then be forthcoming. Focus on cultivating the goodness in yourself first until you can be your own refuge. You've heard enough of the Buddha's Dhamma and the teachings of the Kruba Ajahns concerning this path of practice. The question remaining is how much faith you have to intensify and tighten up your effort every day and night. Take a look at Lumpu Mahabua. Occasionally, in his early years, he'd be defeated by Kilesa. Kilesa would overcome his mind to the point that his samadhi waned in strength, but he vowed revenge. "You damn Kilesas, you want to fight, do you?" Talking to his Kilesas, he'd say, "You dirty bastards, I'm going to kick you out of my heart. One day you'll die in my hand. I'm going to wipe you out." Please excuse my language, but this was how Lumpu would speak of his defilements. He vowed revenge. "You damn Kilesas got the best of me. Because of you, my samadhi deteriorated. You caused me nothing but anguish." He was a fighter. His effort never retreated. "Damn it, Kilesas, you even brought tears to my eyes. But mark my words, I'm going to punch your lights out." Real meditators are willing to take it to this extent. Feud with Kilesas, but don't feud with your friends in the monastery. Don't feud with the lay people or anyone else. Feud with the sensual desire, anger, and delusion in your own heart. Take revenge on them. Scold them. Don't surrender. Don't buckle under. Rebuke yourself. Take the blame yourself. Admonish yourself rather than rejecting the blame on other people. Search for the faults in your own heart. Whenever harmful thoughts arise, find a way to defeat those Kilesas. That's how the Kruba Ajahns put forth effort. If Kilesas are still present, don't go getting involved in society. Find a way to slip off into solitude. Some monks think like that. Then, if you want to personify Kilesa, it's like you enter a knife fight, one-on-one. It's mortal hand-to-hand combat, and the best one survives. Strangle and stab those Kilesas. It's serious business. If Kilesas are still present, a real meditator won't allow those defilements to get involved in society. It just creates turmoil and disturbance. So the Kruba Ajahns sought solitude, retreating to peaceful, quiet places. They lived in forests, mountains, and caves. They dwelt in isolation and developed bhavana, not allowing their hearts to waver and lead them back into society. Getting involved in society is just taking one's kilesas to go bother other people and create civic havoc. So the Kruba Ajahns withdrew to remote locations. "I'd like to have my monks dwelling in solitude as well, so there's not much to do in this monastery besides developing bhavana. I've cut the commitments outside the monastery down to the minimum. I feel this is more beneficial than getting drawn out by external business and distracted by those outside events. Such distractions won't do meditators any good. Don't forget why you've taken up these brown robes. Why do you go forth from the world to ordain? Why did you don these robes? We took up wearing these three robes in order to practice Dhamma for the ending of all dukkha, for the cessation of dukkha, not for praise, fame, and comfort. We wear these robes for the ending and cessation of dukkha. They are the victory banners of the arhats. But 90% of those who ordain forget this. They lose the spirit. After being ordained for a while, they become indulgent. They forget, they eat, then sleep, and don't put forth effort into their Dhamma practice. Their effort wanes. Wherever there's a ceremony happening, they go off to boisterously socialize and mingle with their friends. This is the way of the world, distraction and chaos. Then they get involved with building and forget themselves, totally losing perspective. They build things that are way out of proportion to what's appropriate, forgetting when to stop when it's just enough. Their desire knows no limits. They're just competing with the world. They forget themselves, forget why they ordained. Now that we're monastics, how are we going to spend our time? Building or bhavana? Which are we going to do? Did we ordain to get caught up in external events and activities? To become monks who give great Dhamma talks? To become abbots? To get distracted by external burdens in order to get the lay people to have faith in us? To go and bother lay people? Some monks think so. So contemplate your original motivation in ordaining. You've come all the way to Thailand from overseas in order to learn about Buddhism, to study the teachings of the Buddha and Lumpa Cha. That took earnest dedication. So now that you're here, take the practice seriously. Have the attitude. Even if no one else is practicing, it doesn't matter. I'm going to practice. I'm going to do it right here. From the bottom of my heart, I vow to renounce kilesas. When you are tired, weak, or exhausted, okay, take a rest, but make sure mindfulness remains continuously vigilant. Rest with the attitude of getting up soon to continue wrestling with kilesas. When the body is tired, then sleep. And as soon as you get up, start putting forth effort into the battle with kilesa. Sleep to prepare for battle. not on and on with no end in sight. Sleep to refresh and invigorate the body and mind for the purpose of eradicating kilesa. Always keep this in mind. It's incumbent upon you to vanquish those kilesas in your heart. Essential desire present? If so, find a way, find a means to abandon it. Is anger or irritation present? If so, find a way to free the heart from it. Don't hold on to and repress it. Find a skillful means to eliminate it. If today, for example, you feel irritated, use mindfulness and samadhi to look for a means to cleanse the heart of that kilesa. Not holding on to and possessing that emotion, inquire into it. Develop metta while practicing sitting and walking meditation until the irritation has finally subsided. Don't allow it to persist in the heart until tonight. Once we lay down to sleep, there mustn't be any defiled emotions lingering to spend the night. Make the heart empty and free from all emotions, free from all the emotions that have been accumulating throughout the day. Clear them all out. Find ways to cleanse and wash them out, steadily carrying on. However many defiled emotions appear and get stuck on you throughout the day, keep inquiring into each of them. That way, when it's time to lie down to sleep, there's only the theme of meditation remaining in the heart. Or do a subha contemplation at that time, visualizing yourself as a corpse. Real meditators put forth effort in every posture. Even when they lay down to rest, they contemplate their body as if it were a corpse. They sustain keen awareness on their breathing or reflect on the Buddha. Then as soon as they wake up, they mindfully begin watching over their heart. In every posture and activity throughout the day, mindfulness and samadhi proceed to develop continuity. All day, all night, every day, and every night, make the awareness constant. Then you'll be radiantly happy in the Buddha's Dhamma. You then begin to understand and see what the Dhamma is all about. You'll be radiantly happy as you strive and persevere. That's how it is for real meditators. For bringing up the spirit of a warrior, contemplating of death is of central importance. When analyzing death, you see there's really nothing here, there. Imagining death spurs us on to increased diligence and persistence. When the Buddha queried his disciples about their meditations on death, some responded that they reflected on it many times a day, some 100, some 1,000 times a day, but the Buddha still reprimanded them for being laxed. Lax. One who is truly contemplating death contemplates with each inhalation and exhalation. Death for him was mindfulness every moment. But those of us who lose our mindfulness need to remind ourselves of the inevitability of death so that the mindfulness might achieve sustained continuity. If the Buddha reprimanded those monks for being lax, what about the likes of us, daydreaming about where we're going to go develop bhavana next year? After the range retreat, I'm going to go meditate at that place. Next year, I'm going to spend the range retreat at such and such a monastery. This year's range retreat hasn't even started, and already some people are thinking about where they're going to go after the retreat. Such distracted thinking drags them from place to place, so it has to be continually cut off. Contemplate death so the mind becomes rooted in the present. If the effort you put into meditation is not yet consistent, then you should devise a schedule for yourself, especially for those monks and novices who are newly ordained and haven't yet developed inner discipline. A schedule for practice is advisable. Even if you're feeling lazy, when it's time to do walking meditation, you walk. When it's time to do sitting meditation, you sit. Once you develop inner discipline, then focus on maintaining constant mindfulness in every posture and activity, standing, walking, sitting, or lying down. Whenever mindfulness slips, then focus again on the subject or theme of meditation. Continually refocusing with mindfulness and samadhi, the mind's defiled emotions are gradually reduced. The heart is freed from emotions, thoughts are freed from emotions, and they steadily decrease. When the heart is empty of defiled emotions, mindfulness becomes established in the present. With awareness sustained on the heart, whenever a kilesa surfaces, it's seen and recognized. Wisdom then has the means to eliminate it. Young monks and novices who are just beginning Dhamma practice, or those monks who've been around for a long time, but whose samadhi is not yet continuous and balanced, should go do a great deal of sitting and walking meditation, develop some samadhi, then you can grab hold of kilesas. Kilesas are like a cobra. Like a cobra the size of your arm, a venomous viper. Samadhi is like a hand that grabs the snake by the neck and holds it fast at arm's length. But samadhi doesn't have the strength to strangle the cobra to death. The strength one derives from samadhi doesn't have the ability to kill the kilesas. However, it can hold the cobra at bay so it doesn't bite you. Without samadhi, kilesas just repeatedly strike, strike, and strike, leaving you wounded and in pain. Samadhi holds the cobra by the neck, but it's a huge snake. No matter how you try to squeeze its neck, it won't die. It's powerful and fatter than your fingers can reach around, so you hold the cobra at a safe distance. Meanwhile, your other hand gropes for a knife or stick to whack it on the head. This is wisdom, panya. One hand holds the snake while the other searches for a weapon to kill it. Panya contemplates and analyzes in order to rid the heart of kilesas once and for all. It's the first one. I have some other stuff that was a rough translation of some Lungpu Ban talks done by the former Ajahn Sanimo, stressing the importance of Kalpatipat. Could I read those? Okay. If compared to other monasteries in general, coming here, you could say that it is falling behind the times, but here it is not our primary concern to be worried about keeping up to date. We take the Kalpatipat to be of much more importance than outward appearances. Therefore, an effort to keep these practices strictly. Try to the best of your ability to maintain and preserve the Kalpatipat that the Krupa Ajahns have laid out for us to follow, so they won't disappear, become diluted, or degenerate. With utmost care, we use the fullest extent of our mindfulness to look after them. Why? Because we see the value in Kalpatipat. If there is no Kalpatipat, there won't, I declare, there will not be any prat to be found within the heart either. There are no two ways about this. I speak of this matter with conviction and without any reservation. Without Kalpatipat, there will be nothing noble within looking at the heart. How about the faith in those hearts of the lay followers and villagers? What is that like? The heart of one who ordains will be like that if there is no Kalpatipat. Therefore, it's just the Kalpatipat that will allow the heart to go forth and bring forth what is noble in the heart. When we see clearly in this way, then letting the Kalpatipat be abandoned, damaged, or ruined, that's not tenable. Therefore, be vigilant, both monks and novices alike. You must speak out immediately, immediately, letting go negligently out of the fear. Oh, there must be some reason or other. We're not like that. If you don't speak out truly, truly you're finished. You're negligent. The heart becomes all bottled up within. Speak out. We're all good people wanting the best for each other. If there's something that has been done in the wrong way and you don't say anything, that won't do. This is going down the wrong track. It is the road to ruin. It's not proper for those who care for one another. We live and die depending on one another, so we must live accordingly. Look after the sasana. Look after the Kalpatipat. For monks, look after the Kalpatipat of the monk. Don't be deficient. For upasaka and upasika, look after the Kalpatipat of the upasaka and upasika. Don't be deficient. Use all the strength of your mindfulness you are capable of in this matter. But this word, capable, this doesn't mean being negligent. Someone's not capable of maintaining it, and so they forsake it altogether. That's not correct. All these things that the Buddha established are all things we are capable of practicing and looking after. The teachings of the sasana was taught with Kalpatipat. If there is Kalpatipat, there'll be the sasana. Living in the forest or jungle, or under the shade of a tree, wherever it may be, where there is Kalpatipat, there'll be the sasana. You don't have to have a big cabinet full of the Tipitaka, or a boat, or a beautiful vihara. You don't have to have anything, only a heart that has Atta-Dhamma. This comes from Kalpatipat, which builds Atta-Dhamma in the heart, causing it to arise and develop. There, you've got the sasana. The heart is truly neither samana nor a householder. The heart is simply the heart. For the heart to go forth fully and completely, the heart must receive training. A heart that is peaceful and composed will be able to receive that training. Whether it is the heart of a villager or the heart of a monastic, then whenever they can receive training in the Kalpatipat and the teachings in both the spirit and letter sufficiently, then the heart itself becomes sila. It becomes dhamma. The heart has peace and composure. The heart itself merges with what lies in the essential meaning of the word samana. It can become what is called pra. The word pra here is referring to sotapanna, sakadagami, anagami, and arahant. These forms of pra are dependent on dhamma, the means by which the heart is trained and effaced. The heart can arrive at the state of samana, that full and complete state of pra. If there is no dhamma to train ourselves with, then looking for pra, we don't see any. Looking for samana, we don't see any. To look for pra, you must look within the heart, because only the heart can be pra, only the heart can be samana, and only the heart itself can be the sasana.
Well, Paul, yeah. In Panjan Dhan's talk, there's much very common in the Portuguese, you know, a lot of emphasis put on solitude. And certainly in this community, we get a lot of opportunity to do that. I mean, we're in the middle of our winter retreat right now, which is really dedicated towards that.
Right.
But we also have a lot of sort of responsibilities and engagement, and there's an emphasis on community as well.
Right.
I was wondering how you would recommend us balancing the two, or using them to help each other, or is it temperament? Is it, you know?
Part of it is temperament, part of it is a certain element of inclination, in the sense that I think with say for a lot of the within the Thai tradition, there's a lot of emphasis on solitude, because there is a by temperament they're not very comfortable with solitude. They're not, and then all the stories of the monks on Tudong and whatnot, and they're always with a group of their mates. It's very, very rare. I think India is very similar in the sense that these are very communal cultures and societies, so that there is an emphasis on solitude, because it tends to kind of cut to the heart of where feelings of security and comfort lie, and that's a there's a certain balance that is needed. Ajahn Chah used the aspects of both solitude and community to recognizing that we have preferences and comfort zones in both of them, and learning how to work with those, and to be ready to investigate what is it that, because in the end it's sort of, well, what is it that brings up greed, hatred, delusion, in terms of either the aspects of liking, disliking, of doubt or restlessness or confusion, so that those are the elements that we need to be paying attention to, and whether it's, say, one is on one's own or whether one is with others, and there is and being able to investigate where those arise from, so that tend to try to put a lot of emphasis on both, so that there's time for getting back to your buddhi and being on your own, and time for interacting with others, so that there's an opportunity for both giving and sharing, supporting others. And particularly, I think, as Westerners, we tend to easily be isolated and have a lot of I think of the classic study of what brings up the most fear and in individuals, and it's down the list is sort of illness and then relatives dying and the world annihilated by nuclear explosions, and that only makes it up to about two or three, but the top of the list is public speaking. If I'm exposed as an individual, as an ego identity, that's the most fearful thing. You tend not to see that in the same way. because, say, like Thailand or Asia is a more communal society, they also tend to have everybody wants to grab that microphone and say something or sing a song or do a skit or, you know, anything. I mean, or if the, you know, there isn't the same kind of isolation, which is a part of the kind of the personality makeup, and therefore, when there is that isolation, then there tends to be an actual over focus on one's own sense of me, so that isn't sort of overcome through theory. It's, you know, it's a nice theory to relinquish self, but it really doesn't happen until you actually come up against it. So that, I think quite rightly that Ajahn Chah saw the need for that balance of both, and learning how to be on one's own and be diligent in practice and be self-sufficient, and also to live with other human beings without a sense of either, you know, threat or fear or confusion, agitation, irritation. So those are balances that we need to learn on both sides. And, you know, each of us has different temperaments that we need to work with.
So maybe you might have any advice on how to hold a particularly strong fighting spirit sort of teaching like I've been done.
Well, I mean, again, it's sort of the, you know, there's a certain cultural element of, say, if you grow up in Thai society, there's a certain element of gentleness that is part of the cultural conditioning. And so that there's a balance is okay, if you're going to practice and be diligent, then you've got to bring up that kind of effort and balance oneself. a lot of it is to sort of see, well, what is it that helps to decrease greed, hatred, and delusion. If there's this sense of constantly kind of fighting and struggling and in constant confrontation all the time, then there's this agitation that can arise. But if it's a source of okay, I could take this seriously, I can't just veg out or eat my fill, go back to my good tea and crash out. I mean, that's not going to cut it by anybody's standards. So that bringing into being some kind of okay, I've got to make a bit of a stand here. I can't just sort of be wishy-washy and just kind of pat my chelaces and look after them, treat them really nicely. It's like, remember Ajahn Chah was saying, when you receive visitors to the, and that's the mind, that sense of, one of the, sayings of the Buddha is how the mind is intrinsically radiant, but it's the visitors to the mind that keep it clouded. And so you say, well, you have to pay attention to visitors that come to the mind, and you know, if you invite visitors into your home and they just make a mess, then you want to close the door on them before they come in. You can't be too polite. And that, you know, it's similar, but in that sense, okay, there's the strong kind of unskillful tendencies are knocking at the door. You want to be sort of being really polite and wishy-washy and invite them in, look after them, keep them comfortable. And you want to be able to shoo them out the door. So then similar, there's times when it's appropriate to just in Ajahn Dhan's talk, he's talking a lot about the warrior spirit, but he's also saying you need to really investigate and understand. You need to be able to develop loving kindness. And those are easily overlooked, and then we focus on this, gosh, you'd be fighting and struggling and pushing. And because that's what we pick up. And it's good to pick up the whole thing and see what is it that's going to work to allow unwholesome dhammas to decrease and wholesome dhammas to decrease without taking a bias towards one or the other. And so that, I think the thing is picking up that spirit in terms of how can I be diligent and consistent in my practice? What is it that supports that kind of diligence and consistency? Because that's really what. And Ajahn Dhan's a really good example of somebody who's over many years. He's been extremely diligent and consistent in his practice, and he's received the fruits of that practice.
That's a good question I have. Is Mandepa got that when he was here? I got more of a sense of metta from him than I got the sense of warrior spirit.
This is sometimes the. I can remember meeting Ajahn, the first time I met Ajahn Mahabhoa was, the epitome of this, kind of the hardline, the warrior. I've been practicing for some time already, and I read different things and heard a lot of various stories, and meeting him, that was the overwhelming feeling. It was this, somebody who was incredibly kind and concerned for other people's well-being, and really this incredible compassion as the overwhelming kind of move. And Ajahn Dhan, very similar. He was here this last year, so that. I don't think anybody felt they were being judged or being kind of ridden roughshod over to conform to some kind of ideal that he was setting. He was sort of, what can I do to help you? It's really the feeling that I think was predominant.
Ajahn Chandoko asked, he started the question with, so he actually sort of like almost led Ajahn Dhan into talking that way.
Right.
So I was kind of wondering if that was sort of his theme of the way he talked, or is he responding, you think, to Ajahn Chandoko's question?
A bit of both. Yeah. A bit of both. Certainly he was, it was a leading question. But also, Ajahn Dhan he certainly put forth the effort. And there's times when you really have to bring up these images in the mind to just, that sense of
said about Ajahn Mahabhua, that whole perception, what you hear about from other people about what you're going to expect.
Right.
And I had the same experience with Ajahn Dhan in Thailand. He was in Ubon.
Right.
And I went from Pujangam to go see him. He was at Wat Pu Mom. And then
right.
another monk was telling me, you know, he's just going to blast you like right away because you know, if he finds out that you're looking after a monastery, he's really against that. Jain monks looking after monasteries. And I was like, wanted him to bless the mala that I had. Like, definitely don't do that, not without him dying. And then he's like, he's just going to blast you. So I went and then we were chatting and Ajahn Dhan was like, oh, who are you? So we were talking a little bit and then he's like, who's looking after Pujangam these days? And I was like, oh, no. And then I said, I am. And then he just smiled and he's blasted me with metta and was just super kind. And then when I asked him to bless my mala, he asked to keep it all night and he focused on each bead and gave it to me. Just like, was exactly the opposite of what I was to expect. It's really kind.
Talked about he was really encouraging his monks to admonish each other on small points of korwa, is what I heard.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there's also what Chan's teaching about pay attention to yourself at least 90% of the time and others only 10.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious if you could sort of set the context of those two.
Well, that's also quite similar in terms of cultural. One of the things in Thailand that you don't do is admonish each other. If you do, you have to be extremely cautious and very gentle, you don't criticize. In terms of a cultural kind of value, it's very difficult to criticize. It's also why Ajahn Chah sort of says, if somebody criticizes you, then you should just raise your hands and Ajahn says, sadhu, because you don't have to hire anybody. You don't have to hire them to do it for you. But it's something that is considered very bad manners. Whereas, there's a different cultural tendency as Westerners. It's like, I was talking with Ajahn Kavli, and it was really interesting because he was sort of saying, in German culture, the way that you actually bond with each other is to start complaining about something and criticizing, because then you've got something to share. And he said, it's so different.
Isn't there a story with Ajahn Chah where he wanted to, give some feedback to the senior monk, but he waited like 20 or 30 years?
I'm not sure how long, but certainly he would wait.
Like when he found the right time, the monk was like extremely grateful. He said he just knew before that he wouldn't have gone over it.
And Ajahn Chah was really good at, he could be pretty direct, but also, he'd be very attuned to that sense of time and place and circumstance, and especially if it were something that were really kind of quite important, then you really want to be waiting. So that Franklin Dan, it's more like an encouragement to support each other in keeping up a standard of training, which is helpful for a community and a monastery. Now, Ajahn Vans his monastery is extremely. I mean, he likes things done in a really. It's the only monastery I've ever seen where the shoes are outside the hall are always neat and tidy. It's really it's sort of part of the training, and it's also probably the cleanest monastery we've ever been in. I remember one of the monks sort of saying, "Yeah, you get up for." Because every afternoon is sweeping. It's like 3 hours of sweeping in the afternoon. And so you're just sort of out there just trying to chase anything, chase out the last leaf. Sort of.